with the Elyria Chronicle Telegram. Jim, how are you? Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Andy. Good. How are you doing?
So far, so good. And I want to dive into the greatness of this team before we get into the documentary, which I know you've already seen. But, boy, the greatness of this team. In your article, I thought you really hit it on the head a couple days ago, talking about just how good they were. And there was a sequence of numbers that you threw at me in 2012. The six division winners in Major League Baseball won their divisions by a combined 27 games, yet that 1995 Indians team by themselves won their division by 30 games. That is just incredible. What were your thoughts on that 1995 team? After the strike ended, going into the season, you knew it would be a shortened year because of the strike. Did you have any idea that team would be that good?
Actually, yes. They were. In fact, if you go back and look at the numbers, when the strike hit in '94, Albert Bell and Kenny Lofton, in particular, were headed to MVP caliber seasons, and their numbers were even better than they were in '95. And in '95, they were both tremendous. So that team just peaked at absolutely the right time. It was unfortunate for them that they had the players strike in '94, because I'm sure they would have won the division and maybe made and maybe even won the World Series that year. But I've always thought that Indians team, the 95 team, was the best team to never win the World Series. I mean, the team was just completely loaded from top to bottom. They were pretty much the best in every category, fielding, hitting, pitching in the American League. And the offense, of course, was just phenomenal. I mean, if you think back on it, you had Tomy and Ramirez batting 6th and 7th. And, you know, Tomy was going to end up hitting 600 home runs, and Manny's at 550-something. And had he not dabbled in steroids, they both would have been in the Hall of Fame. I'm sure Tomy's going to be in it. But, I mean, to have two, you know, Hall of Fame calibers that far down your lineup, and it was just like a loaded lineup, and every guy was really, except for maybe Eddie Murray, who still had a good year, every one of those guys was squarely in their prime years, and it was just something to behold. I mean, they didn't just beat teams. I mean, they just made a mockery of the competition in many of them.
Yeah, they crushed those teams, and I'll never forget that 1-0 loss in Game 6 against the Braves. It was a solo shot from Dave Justice off of Jim Poole, which ended it. But, I mean, you know, that team was just so special, so much fun to watch. And I know you detailed this in your article as well. It's crazy to sit back and think about it, though, but really without the steroid allegations and some other elements, I mean, this 7 out of 9 in that starting lineup really had the potential to be Hall of Famers. That really was kind of a murderer's row starting lineup, no question about that. And the guy at the forefront was Albert Bell, you know, a polarizing figure. And you mentioned this also, that he didn't really make an appearance in this documentary, and I know you can only say so much about it since it debuts tonight, but you mentioned in there that he calls and he leaves a voicemail, and you got to watch it tonight to find out exactly what he says. But covering a guy like him, what was that like back then, just to cover a guy like that?
Well, it was a kind of a double-edged sword. I mean, it was a major pain from a reporting standpoint, because he was so temperamental and just so he didn't like the media, obviously, and it was always one distraction and one explosion after another. But when you watch him play the game and how he played, in fact, that 95, the 95 version of Albert Bell might have been the best I've ever seen, just for just the sheer intensity and insatiable hunger to just excel at his profession. I mean, they were winning, you know, we mentioned 30 games they won the division by. So basically the last 6 weeks of that season was, I mean, it was over. The division was, if not officially clinched, it was all but officially clinched. And, you know, human nature is, in players in that situation will kind of tend to ease up a little bit. But Albert got even more intense as the thing went on. He ended up that year, I think it was, with 100 extra base hits, I think it was, and he had 50 homers and 52 doubles or something, and everyone else was kind of taking it easy going down the stretch because the thing was already over with, and Albert was more intense than ever, and he was just slamming home runs right to the very finish, and he didn't have any kind of a lower gear. He was just all in on everything, and he was the one guy that Charlie Manuel, the hitting coach of that team, would always say that he was the most prepared hitter he ever coached. I mean, he was constantly watching tapes and in the batting cage and working really hard to get better, and he was just a kind of like a contrast, you know, from a person to person standpoint. It was very difficult to deal with him. But if you like to watch great baseball and a great hitter, I mean, that was something to behold, him in that 95 season.
Yeah, it was a special season, no question about that. I mean, every time he came up, you just had the feeling something special was going to happen. You know, take the personality out of the equation, but boy, what a ball player. Just so fun for us to watch here. I think, Jim, back to all these personalities that were on this team, so many guys from so many different walks of life. In your mind, what does that say about a guy like Mike Hargrove, the skipper of that team, dealing with all these personalities?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people would assume that when you have that much talent on one team, you know, you just throw the some balls out on the field and sit back and watch them pile up the wins. But that wasn't the case. That was a gigantically talented team, and there was a gigantic amount of egos on that team, and that's where the managing part of it comes in, because there was a lot of tugging and pulling and guys keeping guys focused throughout the year, and every one of those guys was a star in his own right, and you know, they had the accompanying ego. So the clubhouse got a. It was a little bit rambunctious at times, but they had that team. Really, I remember most for just the swagger they had when they came out on the field. I mean, other teams, you could almost physically see the other team intimidated by just them just taking batting practice. I mean, balls would be flying, you know, 20, 30 feet over the walls, and they just had this air about them that they were invincible. Going back to that World Series you mentioned, they lost the 1-0 in Game 7 against the Braves. If you watch this documentary tonight, you'll see some of the pitches that were called strikes in that game, specifically in the last game, where this happened for some reason that whole postseason. The Braves pitchers especially, but a lot of teams were getting it, but the Braves were able to take more advantage of because of Smoltz, Glavine, and Maddox. They were able to put the ball like 2, 3, 4 inches off the plate. The strike zone all of a sudden became like extremely wide, and there were balls that were thrown to the Indians in that series and in that last game especially that they showed tonight in the documentary that was so far off the plate. I mean, the batter had to swing in it because it was going to be called a strike, but they had no chance of making any contact. Now, Mike Hargrove correctly points out that they didn't lose because of the umpires, but the strike zone back then in that World Series especially was almost comical to see.
We're talking with Jim Ingram with the Elyria Chronicle-Telegram here on Bullseye on the Afternoon. And getting back to the documentary, you know, how much of this is spent on the aftermath of Vizquel and Mesa? You know, that seems like that never really fizzled down. People are still talking about it. You think those guys will ever reconcile?
I kind of doubt it. I think that was a pretty deep one, and I don't think either guy – I think Jose's a little more intent on keeping alive the – you know, the feud, whatever you want to call it, which can't be much of a feud now since they're both retired. Omar, I think, was kind of amused by it to a certain extent. But, you know, after he got hit about the eighth or ninth time when he faced Mesa, I think the humor in it kind of escaped him. But, you know, it was something that Omar said in his book and about the way Mesa pitched in the ninth inning of that seventh game in 97. And Mesa didn't like it, and he basically announced every time he ever faced Omar from that point forward he was going to hit him, and he pretty much did. And it got to a certain point where it was almost like, all right, you made your point. There's no need to keep throwing at Omar. But Omar, I have to say, took it like a man, or took it in good, you know, conscience. I mean, I think he realized that Mesa was the one that was looking bad in this whole thing. And but that feud is talked about and covered a little bit in the documentary tonight. They really did a nice job in this thing of talking to all the people you really would want to hear from that era. And you know, it was I remember from covering that team back then, it was almost in spring training in some of those years, every day like a new future Hall of Famer would show up. I remember one year, I think, they signed Hershiser one day in spring training. And the next day, Dave Winfield comes walking through the door, and it was just a parade of guys that they were almost signing guys on a daily basis to try to get a World Series championship. And some of them stuck around and made big contributions, and others, like Winfield, really didn't. But it wasn't because they weren't trying to remember. Another time they signed, I think it was Jack McDowell, just a few years after he'd won the Cy Young, to the pitching staff, and he didn't turn out to be a Cy Young caliber pitcher for them, but it seemed like any time there was a big-name guy available in that era, the Indians would be the first in line to try to take him. It was almost like the Indians had become the Yankees in that regard, because they were drawing, I mean, you know, 455 consecutive sellouts. All of a sudden, you know, they're getting money on attendance record-setting attendance that they never used to get. So, you know, they poured that right back into the team and tried to sign as many good players as they could.
How much of this documentary was spent on Sandy Alomar, you know, the true leader of this team? I mentioned the line about 20 minutes ago, and it's something I'll never forget. When this team is constantly discussed, you know, Albert Bell gets brought up because he was the figure that he was. But one of the things I always heard was that being as though Bell was the powerful guy that he was and, you know, being very polarizing and all that good stuff, even Albert Bell knew not to mess with Sandy Alomar because he was the true leader of this team. How much of this documentary is spent on Sandy?
There's quite a bit. I mean, he's one of the main spokesmen for the whole, throughout the documentary. There's a lot of interviews with him. Sandy's always been a very good observer of the game and the people in it and, you know, the kind of the chemistry of a team and stuff. So he was able to his comments and opinions and views on that whole era, I think, are really well done because he really had a good handle on that. If you remember, 95, now, he was injured for quite a bit of that time. And, in fact, Tony Pena, you know, hit the big home run in extra innings to beat Boston in the first round of the playoffs that year. But Sandy hit a gigantic home run himself 2 years later when he hit the homer off Mariano Rivera that kind of sent the Indians past the Yankees in the ALCS. So, he was in there with all those guys in all that that era, and he's a good spokesperson for that era from the player's point of view because he wasn't as wildly emotional as some of the other guys were on that team, and I think he was a very mature observer of the team at that time, and he speaks very well about it now, giving you the opinion on what it was like to be a player on that team back then.
And when you watch this thing, Jim, did you learn anything new about that 1997 Kenny Lofton trade? Because at the time, I mean, that was a real gut-wrencher given his legacy here. And, you know, I go back and forth. At the time, I'm not sure what was more gut-wrenching given the circumstances, the Lofton trade or the Baerga trade, you know, given that Baerga meant so much to this team as well. But do we learn anything new about the Lofton trade?
I would say only in the sense that that really was driven by their thought process that they probably weren't going to be able to re-sign Kenny. He was approaching free agency, and the previous year they'd allowed Albert to walk because they didn't want to pay the money to bring him back, and so they traded Kenny to Atlanta for Marquise Grissom and David Justice, who both had big years for them, and ironically they went to the World Series that year that they traded Lofton. But you're right, that was a shocking trade, and also as was the Baerga trade. Now, the Baerga trade was a little different because they traded him. It was almost like night and day. They traded him exactly the right time. His career, almost to the day he was traded, started going downhill very fast. And I remember John Hart telling us that he actually talked to Charlie Manuel, the hitting coach back then, and said, "I'm thinking of trading Baerga. What do you think?" And Charlie, who was a very, very good judge of talent, said, I think he's peaked out. I think it's going to be all downhill for him from here, so don't feel bad about trading him." And sure enough, they traded Baerga. And if you look at the arc of his career, it started at that mid-season 96 trade of him to the Mets, and he really never had anything even close to the kind of years he had in his prime with the Indians. Now, Lofton continued on and had several very good years and played for quite a while after that, and I don't think it's a coincidence. A lot of the teams he played for when he was bouncing around near even in the end of his career were championship teams. I mean, he was able to add, you know, an ingredient of speed and a veteran presence that I think was helpful to those teams. So those were two of the biggest shocks of that era, though, for sure, the Baerga trade and the Lofton trade.
Yeah, two big ones, no question about that. Again, the documentary debuts on MLB Network tonight, The Dynasty That Almost Was. What a phenomenal era of Indians baseball. So much fun to cover. Jim, thank you very much for your time. We certainly appreciate you stopping by and talking to us, and we'll have to have you on again soon.
Okay, Andy. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.